Agnes Poirier, lovely to see you for 20 Questions With. You have managed to straddle the Paris and London lives and worked in both the French capital and the British capital. You've written several books, but I want to focus mostly on Left Bank, Art, Passion, and the Rebirth of Paris, 1940 to 1950, and the more recent book still, Notre Dame, The Soul of France. So the overall focus of this podcast is Paris. And Notre Dame is a really interesting way into it because you wrote it as a consequence of witnessing the burning of Notre Dame and being curious to understand, I think, your reaction to it and maybe the reactions of others. Can you briefly explain to us why that was so symbolic in France?
Well, I mean, it was the 15th of April 2019, and when I am in Paris, I'm lucky because I live opposite Notre Dame on the left bank. So I'm facing the south rose window of Notre Dame, glorious. And that night, the French president was going to address the nation because of the yellow vest movement, the Gilets Jaunes. So I was actually preparing for a long BBC interview, commenting on what he was going to say and the measures he was going to announce. And then it was about 7 p.m. I was in my kitchen, and I turned my head and I looked through the window, and I saw the biggest clouds, and they were yellow clouds, and they looked ominous. And I thought it must be coming from a huge place, a huge building. And I thought, well, the only huge building I know is Notre Dame. So I rushed to my front room and then went on the street. And it was a scene, a sort of biblical scene, because people were like frozen statues with their gaze turned towards Notre Dame. And even the cars had stopped, and it was an eerie silence. And imagine the left bank, it's usually extremely noisy, and people were speechless, really. And it looked already dramatic, and the firemen were not around, so something had gone terribly badly. So that was the beginning of a real journey for a lot of people, because we were incredibly upset. I discovered, with all the media calling me from different parts of the world, that the people I had on the phone were also extremely upset. Some TV anchors, CNN, were in tears. And they were telling me, "Agnès, tell us why we feel that way." So it meant there was this suspended moment that was shared by millions of people around the planet. And I tried to find the words. It's of course a feat of Gothic architecture, prowess of humanity, standing there for almost 900 years, magnificent, etc. But there was something else, necessarily. I knew it was much more than a church. It was a symbol of France. It's also, interestingly, kilometer zero of France. That is to say, if you put your sat nav, Paris, and you just say Paris Center, it will take you right there. And it's really after 2 or 3 days of just commenting on the news around the clock that I wanted to investigate. And my publisher in London said, "Look, I'm upset. I'm not even Parisian. I'm not French. And I want to understand why." So I researched, looked at the history, and I found out 10 key dates in its history that explains why Notre Dame has this very special place in our heart, but also in French history, of course, but might be very revealing or talking to people throughout all over the world. And but I also wanted to start with a fire and end with an ending chapter at the moment we knew it was saved. And so I met from the General Gallet, who was the head commander of the firemen, the clergy, the bishop, the architects in chief, art historians, all the people who were there that night. And so I wanted to start writing this history book like a thriller. So you've got the night of the fire and then the 10 key dates. And I learned so many things by just diving into the archives and looking at architecture, politics, the lives of kings and queens in France, of course, but the French Revolution, Victor Hugo, etc., etc.
Is it a paradox that it holds such an important place in the French psyche, given that France is famously a secular state?
Not really, because, well, first of all, we've been a secular state for a very short time, since 1905. So that's not a very long time, considering Notre Dame was built in the 12th century. And also France is deeply, historically a Christian, a Catholic country. But what happened that night, I've seen, I saw scenes in the streets of Paris I never thought I would ever see. That is to say, some people on their knees, some people praying, not praying loudly, because this is not done in France, religion belongs at home. But that night they were in the streets, so therefore there were conspicuous displays of emotion, religious emotion. But if you think that Notre Dame is the place where we celebrated all our glorious but also tragic moments, in a way, nothing to do with religion and the way it started, just think about the way Notre Dame was financed. Usually Gothic cathedrals at the time were financed by the aristocracy and, of course, the kings. Not with Notre Dame. Notre Dame was paid for by the bourgeoisie of Paris, but also by Maurice de Sully, who was the bishop of Paris, the son of peasants, the son of farmers, but also the prostitutes of Paris paid for Notre Dame. So it was the people's palace. It was also the first ever public museum in France, because you could go there and look at all this, magnificent sculptures and also paintings. And it is a place that was not closed during the French Revolution. This is where the revolutionaries celebrated their deeds, their actions, which you might think were not very Christian. But for them, the providence or God was on their side. So Notre Dame is this concentrate of French history. And this is where, if you think back just a few years, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, we're talking about cartoonists, journalists who were staunchly anti-clerical, and yet Notre Dame sounded the loudest, and it's called the Bourdon, even in English. It's the bell that is almost 400 years old, and it is used and it rings very, very occasionally because it's quite precious for big events. And Notre Dame tolled for those anti-clerical people. So you see, it's really a place that goes far beyond religion.
How successful has been the restoration of it?
It's quite extraordinary. It's not even 5 years since the fire, and it will reopen in a few months' time, actually exactly on the 8th of December at 11:30 a.m., I'm told. It's gone so fast and so well. And at any given time, there are about between 500 to 1,000 artisans working there. And it's a city within the city, because it's, when you get on the building site, you need to change completely to have a shower, to change because of lead, because of pollution, because of security. And so there are the canteens, you're not going out. You're just staying there all day long. And you live there, and there are archaeologists, there are artisans, of course, stone, glass, wood, carpenters. The framework is now finished. The wood framework is now finished. But you also have anthropologists working there. And of course, the architects in chief, they've got their offices there. And it's beautiful to look at. You know what? I think Parisians will miss seeing that giant building site, especially at night. At night, it looks like a science fiction spaceship, because it's lit from within. And I've got so many videos, films, pictures that I've taken over the last 5 years. And you see the progression. And I'm sure we're going to miss it.
So another extraordinary chapter in the history of Paris. I wonder what the Eiffel Tower means to the French, because it's possibly even more famous globally than Notre Dame. How important is it to you guys, to the French people? And remind us why it was built and when it was built and its significance at the start.
Well, it's interesting you're mentioning the Eiffel Tower that was built for the Universal Exhibition of 1889, because it's made of iron, of course, and it's very, very young compared to Notre Dame. There was this beautiful picture that I really wanted for the cover of my book, Notre Dame, the Soul of France, for the British edition. And it was taken from quite far away, from what, 5 kilometers away, from a roof in a suburb in East, just outside of Paris. And it shows, because of the perspective, and it flattens everything, it looks as if the Eiffel Tower, this young, you know, thing, is looking at Notre Dame, which is engulfed in fire, with some sadness. You know, it's the young youth looking at venerable Gothic architecture. It's a beautiful picture. And, you know, when Bartholdi went, because Bartholdi did, as you may remember, he built the Statue of Liberty, and he was using very much FL, very modern way of building in iron and the infrastructure. Well, he also visited Notre Dame and the building site, because Notre Dame almost disappeared in the early 19th century, and it was saved first thanks to a sort of national campaign and awareness raised by Victor Hugo and his famous novel, Notre Dame de Paris, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and by this very young architect, Viollet-le-Duc, who between 1840 and 1865 completely rebuilt and restored, rather, Notre Dame, which was just crumbling down. And so Viollet-le-Duc and Bartholdi had a conversation on the roof of Notre Dame, and that was obviously 20 years before the Eiffel Tower was built, but they were talking about new ways of doing architecture, and they worshipped medieval knowledge, the medieval skills, but we're also looking forward to and towards the future of architecture. So I love this sort of a meeting of minds. And the Eiffel Tower, as seen from the towers of Notre Dame, and Notre Dame as seen from the second or the third floor of the Eiffel Tower, are in a permanent conversation. It's wonderful.
And what does it mean to the French, the Eiffel Tower? How important, how does it rank compared to Notre Dame?
Well, it's about modernity. Notre Dame, having been around for almost 900 years, it's about permanence, if you like. It's about immortality. Whereas the Eiffel Tower is about the modern age, and also what Paris meant to the world for at least until, you know, the Second World War, the epicenter of culture and arts, and of the avant-garde, really, of things that weren't done before. It's about audacity, about daring. It's about thinking in new ways.
How much of what we see of Paris today, of what Paris looks like today, is owed to Georges Eugène Haussmann, the architect that Napoleon III engaged from Bordeaux, I think he was, to sort of redesign Paris, the mid-19th century?
It's the 1870s, if you'd like. So Napoleon III, whom Victor Hugo, who really disliked the guy, called Napoleon the Small, as opposed to obviously Napoleon the Great, who was his uncle. Napoleon III did spend most of his life in exile and in London. So when he arrived in power in Paris in the 1850s, he didn't really care for Paris. He didn't know Paris, really. I mean, he knew it was the capital of his country, but so he could, in a way, be extremely daring. And he wanted to clean Paris of its sort of medieval and insalubrious quarters. And so he instructed the Baron, you can also call him the Baron Haussmann, to make it more hygienic, if you like, you know, big arteries, big boulevards, buildings for the middle classes, but with water, with gas, with electricity, all the sewage system also, the metro. And when you're a Parisian, you really regret the time before Baron Haussmann, where you could, you know, Paris had a lot of quarters that were still medieval. And this has been almost completely wiped out and demolished by Baron Haussmann. On the other hand, Haussmann gave us those beautiful buildings, really, and this uniformity, and also, you know, the Paris Opera, Palais Garnier, and also those big squares or big places with a star shape. And it is very much the identity of Paris today. And also, it hasn't changed much since the 1870s. So this is really the modern Paris that became so iconic and that was painted by all the impressionists from the 1870s onwards.
How do we fit the French Revolution of, you know, 1789 to 1799? How do we fit that into the broad sweep of the history of Paris?
Well, a lot of the places, although obviously the French Revolution took place almost 100 years before the big works and big reshaping of Paris by Baron Haussmann. Still, you know, there's still the Bastille, although it's not a prison anymore. It's an opera built by François Mitterrand, the late French president, in the 1980s and 1990s. It's still there. And actually, as I discovered with great amazement, is that, for instance, everybody remembers the storm of the Bastille on the 14th of July, 1789. But what about the day after, when all the revolutionaries who had, chopped a few heads on Bastille Day went to Notre Dame to get a celebratory mass, because history and God were necessarily on their side? You know, the night of the 4th of August, 1789, when they were in at the National Assembly and they voted to abolish all privileges. At dawn, they rushed to Notre Dame to celebrate. And you could say in a way that abolishing privileges is a very Christian thing to do. But of course, at some point, they banned religion altogether. But Notre Dame was still open. They banned religion, but they also, at some point, they decided to make it a state religion. So people would have to vote for their priest. So Notre Dame became this big polling station where people would go and vote. During the Terror, Notre Dame was a lecture hall where every law was debated and explained, rather, to the public. It was also a wine warehouse, because all the wine confiscated from the aristocrats were stored there. You know, beautiful conditions, a bit humid and quite cool. You know, the best wine cellar there is. So when you walk in the streets of Paris, the revolution is still there.
If you're trying to locate the soul of Paris in terms of a decade or a half century or a century, when do you think that was or is?
Well, it depends on what matters most for you. You know, whether you're of a revolutionary spirit or you're more of an artist, you're a modernist, or you're into existentialist or existentialism, or the May 1968 events, or you're fanatic about the French New Wave, or Gothic architecture, or even Roman history, because, you know, we have a Roman arena and we have former baths, Roman baths, in the heart of the Left Bank. So, you know, there's history at every corner of the street in Paris. That's the beauty of it.
I think you've said before that it has never been greater than the 12th century.
Yes, I said, I discovered that Notre Dame was built during 150 years of continuous growth and economic growth. And when I say growth, I mean a boom, an expansion we've never witnessed since. Imagine, even now, you know, we go from cycle to cycle, you know, the economy is good for what, 4 or 5 years, and then there's inflation or there's a war somewhere, and then, you know, things go pear-shaped, and then, okay, it's a bit better. But imagine 150 years during which the French and the Paris bourgeoisie became richer and richer and richer, and could actually give a lot of money for the building of Notre Dame. And so it was also during that time that university was born really in Paris, and then suddenly students from all over Europe were coming to the left bank already. We're talking about 12th and early 13th century. So that was an amazing period to be living in.
When did the left bank become the left bank?
Well, you could argue it was during the 12th century, you know, because it was already where the university started and great professors settled, and students lived on the left bank because it was cheaper than on the Île de la Cité, that is to say the island where Notre Dame is. But of course, you might think that it's more just after the war, you know, with philosophers, with Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, and Juliette Gréco, and this was the golden age of the left bank as we modern think about.
Give us a bit more of a taste for your book, Left Bank, and some of the other protagonists that you feature. I know you had to whittle down the list of characters, but just explain to people why it was such an important space, both during the war, but also then after the war, in the rebirth of Paris after its liberation.
Well, if I go back to 1900, for instance, you know, the places to be an artist, or the intellectual life as well as cultural and artistic, were in Montmartre, in the north of Paris. You had the Bateau Lavoir, where Picasso started working, where Cubism and abstraction were born. And then in the 1920s, you know, Hemingway, and of course, Josephine Baker, for instance, and the artists of the 1920s, they were in Montparnasse. But you could argue south of the river, close to left bank, to the left bank. But then there's the war and a new way of thinking. And Camus, Sartre, Beauvoir, Beauvoir and Sartre were philosophy teachers, and they taught in lycée. Camus was a writer. He was slightly younger than them. And, you know, just after the war, this is where all the jazz musicians would gather and go to what we call jazz cellars. That is to say, in buildings, they would go down in what used to be wine cellars and start jazz clubs. And a lot of American jazz musicians would come just after the war. They were attracted by Paris just after the war, but also they were fleeing racial segregation. You know, Miles Davis had an epiphany when he arrived. He was only 22 when he arrived with Dizzy Gillespie in Paris in the late 1940s. And it's also the place, the Left Bank and the Latin Quarter, if you like, is the place where students are. And so there was this concentration of ideas, new ideas, because, you know, Paris had been occupied. Paris hadn't suffered what London suffered, that is to say, the bombs, you know, the Blitz. It had suffered perhaps more profoundly, but not, you know, it didn't have the scars that London had. Suffering was more interior, and a lot of existential questions, because the next generation didn't want to make the same mistakes as their elders. And there is, of course, the existentialist philosophy, which is a philosophy of engagement, of the committed, engaged intellectual, as we say in French. That is to say, somebody who knows that not to decide is as important as to decide. You know, you decide to resist during the war, and being passive is also a choice of existence, and a choice that bears responsibility. It's not, you know, nobody can escape. It's human condition, as they call it. And also It's choices or lack of choices. So it's really a philosophy of responsibility, of individual responsibility. And what else? Of course, you had a lot of American GIs on the GI Bill. They had fought, they were extremely young, they had fought during the war, and thanks to the GI Bill program, they would come to Paris and pretend to learn French at the Sorbonne. In exchange, they would get some dollars every month, and that would pay very comfortably for, you know, food and a little room in a hotel on the left bank. So we've got Norman Mailer. Saul Bellow was already an academic, but he came at the time. James Baldwin, Richard Wright was not a student because he was already a very successful Black American writer, but still he came to Paris. So there was this, and later Chester Himes. I mean, there was this concentration of international students, American students, Ellsworth Kelly, for instance, Jack Youngerman, painters, and they all met and they all influenced each other.
Tell the story of Hemingway turning up at Picasso's studio.
Well, that was in August 1944. He was with the embedded, I think, with the 4th Infantry Division, American Infantry Division, that was there to help the Free French to liberate Paris. And he had his own Hem Division, as he called it, you know, made of a few, not mercenaries really, but some special forces. A bit like him, not very orthodox. And so they were in their jeep and they rushed to Paris, and they went first to Rue de l'Odéon to just say hello to Sylvia Beach, who had and Adrienne Monnier, who were two bookkeepers. And of course, Sylvia Beach is very well known because she started Shakespeare Company, the great and celebrated bookshop. And then from then, they stopped a few yards, you know, a few yards away, Rue du Quai Saint-Augustin, at Picasso's workshop and atelier studio, if you'd like. And Picasso wasn't there. So the concierge said, do you want to leave a note? Do you want to leave something to Mr. Picasso? And Hemingway just took a crate of grenades, of hand grenades, and left a note from Hemingway to Picasso and gave it to the concierge, who wasn't sure what to do with it. And then he went straight to the Ritz, of course. I'm not sure to liberate the Ritz and the Ritz bar, but and yes, that was the beginning of the liberation of Paris by Hemingway.
How prominent was Paris in the French resistance?
Well, since it was occupied, it was... you know, the conditions were harsh from the beginning for Parisians, especially for those who had remained, because obviously a lot of Parisians left to go to Free France. I mean, I'm hesitating to say the word because it was Vichy France and it wasn't really free, but at least it was not occupied by the Nazis until November 42, when France was fully occupied by the Nazi occupiers. And so life was difficult. People were hungry. The ration was 1,000 calories per adult. You know, it's half what you need. So it was a way, you know, it was a way to quell any resistance. Also, people had great difficulty finding fuel, finding coal to heat their homes. So people were in constantly cold during winter, and the winters were extremely harsh during the war. And of course, they had to live in symbiosis, as Jean-Paul Sartre said, with the occupants. And they had to continue working if they wanted to put, you know, food on their table. So in a way, they were contributing to normal life. But not normal what life meant contributing to an economy that was serving Nazi Germany. So the feeling was terrible, because unless you were resistant and you were morally, you know, working, fighting towards the liberation of your country. Well, if you were not resistant, then, you know, there were a thousand different shades of collaboration or passive resistance. It was, you know, Parisians, it must have been very difficult for them to live and to answer their own questions. Should I live? Should I leave France? Should I go to America? Should I go to London and join the Free French of General de Gaulle? Jean-Paul Sartre, for instance, who had been taken prisoner, who managed to escape his prisoner's camp in Germany, arrived in Paris and told Simone de Beauvoir, we need to start to and resist. But they wanted to resist with words. And they tried to galvanize fellow academics. They tried to create a cell, but a lot of their fellow writers said, no, we don't want to fight with words. We want to fight with weapons. And that was the end of their resistance cell. They went back to their students. They went back to their books. And later, Jean-Paul Sartre would be accused by active resistance of having been an armchair resistant.
What was censorship like in wartime Paris? How much of a stranglehold did the Nazis have over the cultural life of the capital?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because if you look at the publishing world, Nazi Germany had a man called Gerhard Heller. He was 31 at the time, and he had been brought up, or at least, you know, studied in France, in Italy. He was a lover of literature, of European literature, and he was appointed as the head of censorship of the whole publishing world in France. And he had really the right to ban books. I mean, life and death of any book went through, you know, through him. And he came up with an understanding very quickly with French publishers who had not closed down, who wanted to continue working during the occupation. And basically, he told them, you'd better censor yourself or you'll be in trouble. And I've got the power to give you the paper you need to publish your books. So you'd better be careful and not be too daring in what you publish. And there's this great case of Gallimard. Gallimard is the biggest publishing house in France, still is, most prestigious. And they chose to continue working. And what they had in their offices is that they appointed a, I wouldn't say Nazi, but a collaborator who embraced the ideals of Nazi Germany. His name was Drieu La Rochelle. But in the little office next to his was Jean Paulhan. And Jean Paulhan was a resistant, underground resistant, of course. The two of them could actually have a conversation because, above all, they love literature. So Drieu La Rochelle helped Jean Paulhan, or covered for Jean Paulhan, to publish the books of communists and resistance. Well, Drieu La Rochelle was publishing some filthy Nazi pamphlet. You know, how is that for ambiguity? And for years it went on. So there was a sort of, Gallimard was publishing some rot Nazi or reactionary rot, as well as great resistance work. And, you know, Gerhard Heller was given the manuscript of The Outsider by Albert Camus, and he read it just in a few hours at night. And he called Gallimard in the morning saying, this is too great not to be published, and I will cover for you, and I will tell the Gestapo there's nothing to worry about, and you can rely on me, and I will give you the paper, the amount of paper you need to publish this book.
Can you paint a picture of the subterranean world of Paris? Of course, you've got the metro today, but you've got the sewers made famous in Les Miserables, but you've got the catacombs. Tell us about the catacombs and just give us a really quick sense of what life is like physically, or has been like physically, underground beneath the surface in Paris.
You mean during the war?
During the war particularly, but also more generally.
Well, the catacombs, I went there for the first time during COVID, and it's an extraordinary place. And I now understand why they are, before COVID and since COVID, there were kilometers of tourists just lining to get inside. Have you ever been, Matthew?
No.
You must go. So basically, through hundreds of years. This is where, because some cemeteries in the heart of Paris were reshaped, or the places needed to be emptied of all the skeletons for building. So through the years, or through the decades, and even through the centuries, a lot of skeletons were stored in the catacombs. And in the 19th century, and it was very much a 19th century romantic, if you'd like, idea, they started organizing the catacombs, and with quotes from poets, and it's arranging all the skulls and the bones, and you get in that underworld, Paris's belly, or Paris's underworld, you know, atmosphere, and you come out completely transformed, really, because you're there with the dead, so many of them, and through centuries, and they are just looking at you and facing you. It's an extraordinary experience.
And the resistance used the subterranean world during the war, did they?
They did, to hide, but also to lead their operations, especially in June to August 1944, when they organized the liberation of Paris and the insurrection of Paris.
Paris, of course, is famous for its fashion. Where does that come from?
Oh, well, I think you need to go back to the Ancien Régime, really, to Versailles, to Louis the, you know, the 14th, to the splendor
Louis XIV.
Louis XIV, the Sun King, absolutely. And also to the talents of the famous weavers from Lyon and the silk trade. But we would need another podcast, Matthew, to talk about fashion.
But can you place Chanel, Coco Chanel, into the history of Paris? Why Paris?
Well, where else? Chanel is very interesting because she was very modern. And she comes at a time of transition for women in France, you know, and she did away with the corset. She did away, you know, it's a time when there's a sort of free the woman's body, you know, stop constraining, restricting what a woman can do. And so she used new kind of textile that you wouldn't necessarily use at the time. And she was really a pioneer when she was very young. And then, of course, she became, you know, Coco Chanel, and with her tweed skirt and jacket ensemble. And also she became part of the story because she had famous love affair during the war with the Nazi officer, and together they lived in the Ritz. And she was not, she didn't go to prison, or she was, it is said, I'm not sure it's true, that Winston Churchill intervened for Coco Chanel so that she wouldn't have to face the questions of resistance for having had such a conspicuous love affair with the Nazi officer. And together they actually escaped to Switzerland for a few years so that, you know, people would forget about them. And then she returned.
We can't talk about Paris and not mention food. Where does Paris's reputation for wonderful cuisine come from, do you think? And do you think that the cooking in restaurants, the food we eat in restaurants in Paris today, is as good as it's always been? And do you think London is now challenging it, unbelievably, given where food was in London when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s?
That's a lot of different questions. But look, I'm not a food historian. So I would say that the importance of food and the art of food and of cuisine, I should say, rather than food, in France comes again from the time of Louis the 14th and Versailles and the sumptuous banquets. There's this famous story of Vatel, the chef of the king, who committed suicide because the oysters hadn't arrived. And it was such a humiliation for him. He couldn't contemplate not serving it. And he just, and you know what? The oysters arrived just after he breathed his last. But What were your other questions? Oh, yes, whether we still eat as well in Paris as we used to. I would say it's the same in Italy or everywhere in Europe. Simple places have become rarer. Places where you were sure to get great simple products cooked simply with a vinaigrette or just cooked, you know, well. And it used to be the fare of cafe and brasserie. You still find wonderful brasseries in Paris, but there's, you know, the progression of the fast food that comes from America, and with all those enhanced tastes, you know, with a lot of glucomate and a lot of sugar and a lot of salt. So, you know, that's not exactly what French cuisine is about. And of course, if you pay a lot of money, you will find some great quality. London has become a great place for cuisine. And you know what? I think I've got a little theory on that. It's because there's not the weight of tradition, the weight of history. And therefore, there's always this curiosity about, you know, food from the whole world. And when I arrived in London in the late 1990s, this is where I discovered Indian food or all those exotic food. Because in France, you don't need exotic food. You don't need to look outwards because French cuisine is, you know, is a whole world. And also, you always have a member of the family that will teach you how to cook French cuisine. So what London gives you is this outlook on the world's finest cuisine. So I think the two are extremely complementary.
You mentioned earlier that some American jazz musicians had fled to Paris in order to escape segregation in America. You might argue that Paris itself is segregated. We haven't mentioned the banlieue. In London, of course, there's huge inequality, but there's an extent to which we're all thrown together. We're all mixed up in our neighbourhoods. In Paris, that seems to be very differently done. I don't know whether by design or because it has developed like that de facto. Can you explain the banlieue and how that fits into the identity of Paris, the narrative of Paris?
Well, the banlieue only means suburbs. The thing with Paris, as opposed to London, you're either in Paris or outside of Paris, because we have the former fortification, the former walls of Paris, which are now the périphérique, that is to say, sort of round, circular, you know, road outside of Paris. And banlieue doesn't mean much because you have very posh banlieue and very poor banlieue. But inside Paris, it's not uniform at all. You've got the 19th arrondissement and the 20th arrondissement and the 11th arrondissement that are quite working class still. And the demographics is extremely diverse. You've got very posh parts of Paris in the 16th, the west of Paris, basically. So it's not as uniform as you might think it is. What you're referring probably to is banlieue as it has become, that is to say, synonymous with riots, especially since perhaps the 25 years ago with the film La Haine that was very successful abroad and in the UK, I remember very well, showing those, you know, big, ugly buildings, high-rise building. And it's still a problem. As you know, last summer we had riots again, triggered by the death of a teenager by the police. And it's different, but it's different to London. But it's the same problems, and they are addressed perhaps differently. But France has the biggest Muslim and Jewish communities in the Western world, for instance. It is extremely diverse. But there's this also this idea that we are part of one nation, whereas in the UK, you've got four nations to start with. So diversity is something that is, you know, you say abroad that you're British, but when you are within the UK, you never say you're British. You say you're English or Scottish or Welsh or Irish. In France, we don't say we're Breton. You know, we don't say we're just French. So it comes from the French Revolution, because we were a very divided, very unruly country, and we decided with the French Revolution to be one. But of course, sometimes it creates tensions.
When you say France has the biggest Jewish and Muslim populations in the Western world, do you mean Europe or Western Europe, maybe? Because I'm sure there are more American Jews than French Jews.
No, as a proportion to the overall population.
Two more questions. One, love. Again, as with food, we can't talk about Paris and not talk about love. How has Paris become almost synonymous with love, or with the idea of it being the city of love?
Well, you're asking the wrong question in a way, because when you're Parisian, this is something that foreigners, tourists keep repeating to you. And you think, why are they talking about how romantic Paris is? So we can only guess that it's, you know, the number of bridges, the Seine River, the buildings, the beauty of things, the way we enjoy the pleasures of the flesh in terms of cuisine, but also, you know, the French New Wave. The way we hold cigarettes, or the way Parisian women dress in a sort of carefree and quite simple, natural way. It's difficult. I know there's a whole literature about how, you know, French women, but also French, do things differently. So you will have to ask somebody else. But I know it's a reputation we have. I think it's to do also with a certain joie de vivre, a certain way of appreciating the pleasures of life.
What's your favourite bit about Paris? What does Paris really mean in summary to you?
Well, what I love about Paris is that you can walk everywhere, and it's designed for the flâneur, as you call it also in English.
A flâneur?
Flâneur. You say that in English as well, I think. Flâneur is a way of walking aimlessly and without any purpose, and yet it's almost a whole philosophy, you know, flâner. It's a beautiful word. And yes, the size of things in Paris, it's on a human scale. There are a few skyscrapers, of course, but on the whole, it's really on a human scale. And also the density of Paris, we didn't mention that. It's one of the highest density of population in the world, and from medieval times. That is to say, it is impossible to, you walk and there's always a metro station at the corner of the street, a baker, a butcher, a fishmonger, a cheese shop, a bookshop, and you're never alone. So you're never afraid, really, because if you scream, many people will hear you. And it's the density of life that is completely fascinating, and it's a heady combination, really.
Agnès Poirier, thank you so much for answering my 20 questions.
Thank you.